Nuclear Blind Spots, Part 2. Exposure to dangerous, health-impacting levels of radiation does not require a massive release of radiation. What's not paid attention to is how low-dose exposure over a long period of time is just as dangerous, if not more so, because it is not taken seriously as a health risk and mostly goes unmeasured and unacknowledged. So when a genuine expert looks at the available data in a whole new way and crunches the numbers around regular nuclear reactor batch releases of radioactive materials, and he tells you,
a permitted batch release, if 3,600 people happen to inhale at that level the radioactive gas that's released, then one of those 3,600 people will develop a fatal cancer in time and pass away. And that's for a single batch release. And an operating reactor might have several batch releases in a day. Now, that is a level of harm that is extraordinarily higher than the authorities assert when they do the calculation what the harms to operating nuclear power plants and are to the population. Those permitted releases are really causing a lot of harm. And that is an unknown danger or an unacknowledged dirty secret of nuclear power.
Well, when researcher, mathematician, and inventor Aaron Datesman explains the dangers of so-called permitted releases from nuclear reactors, and that is just one source of exposure to low-level radiation, you get a very specific, scientific, verifiable, and footnoted explanation of the problems that we face from that dangerous, deadly, awful seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we continue with part two of our interview with the co-authors of a brilliant new book, Dirty Secrets of Nuclear Power in an Era of Climate Change, Doug Brigge and Aaron Datesman. Their book provides new, detailed information about nuclear power dangers, including why so-called permitted radiation releases from operating nuclear reactors should never be permitted, period. And we'll let you know how you can access their book for free. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than anyone has the stomach to closely examine right now. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, November 5th, 2024, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. According to a recent New York Times article, projects to update the U.S. nuclear arsenal are underway, and boy, are they spending. The country plans to spend almost $2 trillion in the next few decades on nuclear weapons we hope to never use. Among other points in this article, the Air Force miscalculated infrastructure costs to replace current Minuteman III missiles with new Sentinel intercontinental ballistic missiles, or ICBMs. The original price tag was $78 billion, but the project now is estimated to cost $141 billion so far. The 2023 Congressional Budget Office report projects that the U.S. will spend $756 billion on nuclear weapons just between 2023 and 2032, a 19% increase from previous estimates. And the Heritage Foundation, the Washington, D.C.-based think tank responsible for Project 2025, has outlined their Nuclear Posture Review 2025, nuclear strategies that go beyond current treaty limits and direct the National Nuclear Security Administration to, quote, transition to a wartime footing. And you wonder why there's no money available in this country for health or human services. Sticking with nuclear finances, the Motley Fool Investing Program asks, given the nuclear energy renaissance, should you buy NuScale power stock? The short answer is no. And quotes from this article include, the stock is incredibly risky at the moment, NuScale won't generate meaningful revenue for years, and concludes, the stock is shaky at best. This is my favorite story of the week. Mark Zuckerberg's Meta has been planning to power a new AI data center with electricity generated from a resurrected from the dead Three Mile Island 1 nuclear power plant. But a rare bee species was discovered on land next to Three Mile Island, where the data center would have been constructed, and ran afoul of regulatory environmental law. As of this recording, it looks like the deal has fallen through. Let's hear it for those killer bees. And now,
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, none that's out of week.
In a pre-election interview with Steve Bannon on his show War Room, ex-Fox News host Tucker Carlson credited demons for the invention of nuclear technology. While some of us may refer to nuclear technology as being demonic, we're using the term as a metaphor. Apparently, Tucker Carlson meant it for real. He said it was obviously not human forces who created the nuclear bomb. He went on to say, I've never met a person who can isolate the moment where nuclear technology became known to man. Oh, German scientists in the 30s? Really? When? Name the date. Or maybe, Tucker, just do a Google search and it will reveal that English physicist John Cockcroft and Irish physicist Ernest Walton first produced nuclear transformations in 1932. And in the next few years, scientists Irene Curie, Frederick Joliot, and Enrico Fermi progressed the science further. Nuclear fission itself was discovered by Otto Hahn and Fritz Strassmann in Berlin, working under Niels Bohr in late 1938. But you just keep telling us about your demons, Tucker baby. And that's why this week you, Tucker Carlson, are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, none that's out of week.
And on the website, we will have a link up to a four-part investigative series by AP national writer Jeff Dunn on aging nukes. The guy nails it. Over to Japan, where the number two reactor at the Onagawa nuclear power plant on Japan's northern coast was put back online on October 29 and had been expected to start generating power in early November. But it had to be shut down again 5 days after the restart, after what they called a glitch, but was really more serious when, as one of its instruments failed, the one for detecting neutrons. In 2011, the facility was hit with the strongest ground tremor among all of Japan's nuclear power plants and just narrowly escaped a direct hit from the tsunami that devastated the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power reactors. At Fukushima Daiichi, Tokyo Electric Power Company continues to tout its extracting nuclear fuel debris from one of the reactors. The extracted debris is about 5 millimeters in length and believed to weigh several grams. But what they've just revealed is that if radiation levels are higher than expected, the debris may have to be put back into the containment vessel. And remember, this is 5 grams out of 880 tons. Of radioactive nuclear debris. At the United Nations, for the first time since 1989, delegates at the First Committee on International Peace and Security of the UN General Assembly, and heeding this call, the delegates voted in favor of establishing a group of 21 scientific experts to study these effects and bring our knowledge of this risk up to date. The UN-mandated panel will be tasked with examining the physical effects and societal consequences of a nuclear war on a local, regional, and planetary scale, including the climate, environmental and radiological effects, and their impacts on public health, global socioeconomic systems, agriculture, and ecosystems in the days, weeks, and decades following a nuclear war, and publish your comprehensive report. Shockingly, the United Kingdom was one of only three countries to vote against creating this scientific panel, the other two being France and Russia. A representative of the UK Foreign Office argued that the devastating consequences of such a conflict are already well known without the need for new study, which brings to mind one of the most dangerous sentences in the world. I know that already. You don't know what you don't know until you know it. So let's find out about nuclear war. Okay? Also in the UK, a significant blaze broke out at a nuclear submarine shipyard in Barrow-in-Furness, Cumbria. This is where the UK's nuclear submarines are being built. As with any nuclear accident that takes place, large or small, the first words that came out were "no nuclear risk." Locals were advised to stay indoors and keep their doors and windows shut. And seven people were taken to the hospital, quote, as a precautionary measure, end quote. All have since been released. In North Korea, state media released a white paper on Sunday accusing South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol of exposing his country to the dangers of nuclear war through his policies towards the North. The document, compiled by North Korea's Institute of Enemy State Studies, that's a name, criticized Yoon's reckless remarks about war, abandoning elements of an inter-Korea agreement, engaging in nuclear war planning with the United States, and seeking closer ties with Japan and NATO. It also referenced the establishment of the U.S.-South Korean Nuclear Consultative Group, formed during a summit between President Joe Biden and Yoon in April of 2023, to step up dialogue and information sharing on nuclear threats. Now, here is the ICANN update with Alistair Burnett, head of media for ICANN, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons.
Hi, I'm Alistair Burnett at ICANN in Geneva, and here's our roundup of October's news from the campaign. The big news for the month is the announcement that the Nobel Peace Prize is going to Nihon Hidankyo, known in English as the Japan Confederation of A and H Bomb Sufferers Organizations. The award ceremony will be held in the Norwegian capital Oslo on the 10th of December. ICANN is honored to have been able to work alongside Nihon Hidankyo and the Hibakusha to push for the total elimination of nuclear weapons. Our executive director, Melissa Park, has said that this award is extremely important. The Nobel Committee has recognized the lifelong work of the Hibakusha to bring the world's attention to what nuclear weapons actually do to people when they're used. It's particularly significant that the Peace Prize comes at this time, when the risk that nuclear weapons will be used again is as high, if not higher, as it's ever been. Next year is the 80th anniversary of the creation of the atomic bomb and the attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki that killed over 215,000 people and harmed countless more. Almost all the Hibakusha alive today were children at the time of the bombings, and their average age is now almost 86. So over the next year, Nihon Hidankyo and ICANN will be urging all countries that haven't yet joined the UN Nuclear Ban Treaty to show the Hibakusha their efforts have been successful by rejecting nuclear weapons and joining the treaty. At the United Nations, the first committee of the General Assembly that deals with disarmament issues has been holding its annual meeting. The first committee gets its name from the first meeting of the General Assembly back in 1946, where its first ever resolution called for nuclear disarmament. This year, a resolution has been passed mandating a new UN scientific study on the effects of nuclear war, something the organization hasn't done since 1989. This may sound like boring bureaucratic process, but it matters. Both policymakers and the public need and deserve a better understanding, based on the best science available, of the effects of nuclear war. Finally this month, ICANN has also been at the Biodiversity Summit in Cali, in Colombia, to highlight the impact of nuclear weapons, from their production to their testing, on the natural environment. The summit is the equivalent of the better-known annual climate change summits, and it's where action on combating the loss of animal and plant life are agreed. ICANN's digital campaigns coordinator, Lucero Oyazun, was there and told me what her message to the people at the summit was.
Well, we came to talk really about three different points. The first one was really just to establish the connections between biodiversity loss and nuclear weapons, and just in general, nature loss, which I think people don't always really know a lot of the details about. The second point was really to make the connection with the needs of ecological restoration and to some extent the science that goes into it. How do we remediate the environments that have been damaged already by nuclear weapons use and testing? Also, the connections with mining and all these other elements in the production chain of nuclear weapons. So that was the second point. And the third point was about funding, because nuclear weapons cost at least $91.4 billion a year. And that's just on stateside, not in what companies are investing in it. And so, what could be done with that money to protect nature and to reverse biodiversity loss if that were being invested in these projects, particularly as the COP16 and the biodiversity framework has identified a huge funding gap?
It might seem obvious to us, but did the people at the summit see the connection between nature loss and nuclear weapons?
I think the initial reaction when I said that we were there with the campaign to abolish nuclear weapons was surprise and a little confusion. And then you would see the penny hit. And it would go, oh. And then either they would kind of be like, well, that's really difficult. Or they would say, like, yeah, how can we help? We hadn't thought about this, but that is terrifying. And is it just a matter of getting rid of these weapons, or what else can we think about? And again, we had resources with them. I want to give a little shout out to our FAQ on our website about biodiversity and nuclear weapons. But it was also just starting the conversations, trying to find out what is already known in their databases, or how their movements have been working on this. Obviously, people from indigenous communities or communities where mining has taken place nearby are the ones who more immediately saw the connections with the environment and were also very eager to kind of get involved and look forward at how we can work together on these topics.
Your presence at this summit was part of the ICANN's wider work on building links between nuclear disarmament campaigns and environmental campaigns. How's that going?
We've had some exciting moments. Obviously, the week of action we recently had connecting the dots with nuclear spending also included a lot of messaging around what this money could do in terms of protecting nature. Like, 1 minute of nuclear weapon spending could plant 1 million trees, right? So those kind of numbers did seem to hit, and we saw some of the more environmentally focused organizations in our network actually take up on that messaging and use this moment. We also hear from other partners that it's a very, very good time to get connected on these issues. And perhaps it's a very good opening conversation to build movement together.
That was Lucero Oyarzun, ICANN's digital campaigns coordinator, talking to me from South America. And this is Alistair Burnett ending this news roundup for Nuclear Hot Seat.
We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, in 2 weeks, it will be Nuclear Hot Seat's 700th episode. Isn't that something to celebrate? 700 episodes. Chronicling the week-by-week story of the fight against nuclear from 3 months after Fukushima in 2011 to today. This show has become a reliable chronicle of our triumphs and setbacks, nuclear dangers and activist resistance, featuring the work of campaigners from literally around the world. According to academia.edu, the show has been cited as a source in at least 300 academic papers, and more keep showing up every month. Now, we're preparing for two major trips. The first is to the Outrider Nuclear Reporting Summit in Washington, D.C. on December 6th and 7th. This is a frontline opportunity to meet and network with international reporters who cover nuclear issues and make our needs known. Then, March 3rd to 7th, 2025, that will be the third meeting of states' parties on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, the TPNW, at the United Nations headquarters in New York. These meetings, held in conjunction with the Nobel Peace Prize-winning International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICAN, will show us where we stand and strategize where we are heading in the international campaign to get rid of nuclear weapons forever. Both are cornerstone events that you need to know about. But in order for me to attend, funds must be raised to cover travel expenses, which are over and above the expense of continuing to produce the show every week. Outrider is graciously flying me in and putting me up, but they are not covering the full range of expenses. The UN trip has to come completely and directly out of the nuclear hot seat pocket. So can you help? Right now would be the time to send a donation to Nuclear Hot Seat, be it a one-time donation of any amount or a monthly cup of coffee, $5 or more, as a recurring donation. All will help Nuclear Hot Seat to continue to present the stories and perspective you won't be getting from mainstream media. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that your donation is tax deductible. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com. There's a red donate button there for you to click on, or you can send directly via Zelle to info@nuclearhotseat.com. No amount is too small or too large, so please don't wait. Go to nuclearhotseat.com to donate and help keep our perspective on nuclear news online. Whatever you can do to help, I'm deeply grateful. Now here's this week's featured interview. Last week, we spoke with Aaron Datesman and Doug Briggy about their new book, Secrets of Nuclear Power in an Era of Climate Change. It's an extraordinary achievement, providing many new takes on nuclear dangers and their connection to climate change. Dr. Briggy is an endowed professor and chair of the Department of Public Health Sciences at the University of Connecticut. He has published extensively about the social and health consequences of uranium mining. Aaron Datesman is a researcher, mathematician, and inventor who has held technical roles at the U.S. Department of Energy and as an engineer at the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center. The book presents evidence that nuclear power is an insecure and unsecurable technology, inherently incompatible with humanity and democracy, and why it is a less than desirable option in terms of addressing climate change. They make the argument that while superficially appealing, nuclear power is too costly, too fragile, I love the use of the word there, too fragile, and slow to implement compared to alternative options such as wind and solar. This week highlights some of the ways the authors are challenging the orthodoxy of thought about nuclear and how its radiation dangers are measured, providing some genuinely new concepts. And at the end of the interview, I'll share information on how you can download a free PDF of the entire book. One point of clarity, when I speak of being at Three Mile Island and staying in Royalton, that is an area like a subdivision that is adjacent to and south of Middletown, facing the TMI nuclear reactors. I spoke with Doug Briggy and Aaron Datesman on September 23rd, 2024.
There was one thing I would mention briefly, if that. So I am not entirely satisfied with the seventh chapter. It's too dense, and I wish I had taken another swing at it. But there is a nice piece in that chapter toward the end, and I fear that not enough people are going to see it because they get turned off by the rest of that chapter. Like I said, a nuclear power plant leaks. It needs to emit continuously into the environment. The industry calls this batch releases. And the batch releases are regulated, although I'm not convinced that the industry really obeys the regulation or measures what it does in order to stay in accordance with the regulation. But you are allowed to emit, for instance, fission gases like krypton-85 into the atmosphere as long as the dose to anyone at the perimeter of the plant doesn't exceed a certain value that's low. And this seems benign for the most part because, oh, there's a regulation, it's low, the authorities say this isn't harmful. But I go through the calculation that shows if the hypothesis is correct, and as Doug has pointed out, and I will be upfront about, my idea is a hypothesis that remains unproved. A permitted batch release, if 3,600 people happen to inhale at that level, the radioactive gas that's released, then one of those 3,600 people will develop a fatal cancer in time and pass away. And that's for a single batch release, and an operating reactor might have several batch releases in a day. Now, that is a level of harm that is extraordinarily higher than the authorities assert when they do the calculation what the harms to operating nuclear power plants are to the population. Again, it's a hypothesis. If the hypothesis proves out, then those permitted releases are really causing a lot of harm. And that is an unknown danger or an unacknowledged dirty secret, I guess, of nuclear power that is an example from the book I wish to call out. I think that particular section is fairly clear. It's worth reading and knowing about. But one fatality out of 3,600 people is actually extremely dangerous.
Yeah, and this is an area where Aaron has pulled me to think, to change my thinking somewhat. I think going into working with Aaron, which preceded writing the book, because we're working on the Three Mile Island
Tremendous error, by the way.
I would have said, and I did in talks that I gave a decade ago or more, that the routine releases were not large enough in their health impact to measure up to the other concerns we're discussing, like the accidents, like the waste disposal, the uranium mining, and the cost, the economic infeasibility. But if Aaron is correct, then the health risks of so-called low exposure are substantially greater than has been recognized. And I think, Aaron, there will be pushback against your hypothesis, even if we generate evidence for it. And to me, that is an example of how sometimes there is an established scientific orthodoxy, which is widely agreed to and almost unquestionable within the field, that could be wrong. And occasionally someone comes along, as Aaron has in this case, and actually questions it and works through the math, as Aaron has, and then, with me and with some others, is gathering evidence to test the hypothesis with empirical data from people living near Three Mile Island in terms of chromosomal abnormalities. So I think that is a very important thing. I think it's something that the public often doesn't assumes that if there's a scientific consensus, it has to be right, but sometimes it's not. There are cases in history where challenges to the scientific orthodoxy have been proven to be correct and the orthodoxy had to change. So, I think it's premature to say that's going to happen here, but it is plausible, in my opinion, and it is certainly worth investigating because the consequences are substantial if Aaron is correct.
Thank you for that insight. That played out very specifically in the chapter about Three Mile Island, which I was there. Your maps were very instructive to me about the fact that, yes, I was walking around outside in the exact place that was the deepest purple, meaning the greatest intensity of radiation at the time the radiation was there. This just gave me further confirmation. Can't say it made me happy, but at least it solidified some information for me.
Yeah, you were in Middletown.
I was actually in Royalton, and I walked into
Well,
Middletown along the banks of the Susquehanna River and was outside for several hours during that day in the late morning, early afternoon. So this was of personal interest to me. And I came across a concept in there I'm not familiar with, and that is the contradiction between physical measurement of radiation dose and biological outcomes. In simple language, what does that mean and why is it important?
I'm glad you picked up on that because I do think that is a new idea that we present in the book that you won't find elsewhere. Physical and biological. So at the end of that chapter, I say, and I think this is a correct insight, that the proponents of nuclear power technology are principally based in the physical sciences. They're physical scientists and they're engineers. And this is the mode of thinking that they employ. So the doses, to the extent that they're known, that were measured from Three Mile Island were measured with electronic devices called thermoluminescent dosimeters or TLDs. That detail doesn't matter, but it does matter that those are electronic devices. Now, the internet is also an electronic device, and you know not to believe everything you read on the internet. It's interesting that a TLD will register 2 millisieverts or whatever was registered, but a biological indicator is actually what's necessary to determine what happens to a biological organism. I'm not a TLD, I'm a person. So my chromosomal response to the ionizing radiation is not necessarily described by an integrating detector like a TLD. To the degree that it's possible, therefore, I think what the chapter asserts is that we should be thinking about biological measures of injury is it possible to give a direct measurement biologically rather than with an electronic device of what happened? And the fact is that that was done, and Dr. Brigge and I are doing it again.
There was one example that stood out for me where you were talking about the numbers, the level of exposure that was being presumed versus the story of an individual who lived within 4 miles of Three Mile Island reporting what happened to his body as a result of having been out there at a time and in a way that there wasn't, quote unquote, supposed to be any impact from the radiation, according to the quote unquote experts. And I'm wondering how often you've been able to track and how you've been able to quantify that correlation between they say that nothing happened, but here are the examples of the people who were there and what actually happened to them.
There's been a lot of work addressing this question by people who came well before us. There's something called the Katagiri Report that I think is mentioned in a reference in the book. In terms of what we've done, I think the answer to the question is that we have examined so far 26 people for cytogenomic analysis, and those selections were based on location, so based on that plume map that's in the book that you saw in which you located yourself. But as for our own study, we haven't yet unblinded who was exposed or not exposed to reference it to the results in terms of the chromosomal injuries that we may be finding. So I don't have a direct answer for your question at this time. That was the aspect of it that you're asking.
The issues of the problems of nuclear waste and the problems of nuclear proliferation are addressed multiple times in publications, in books, in discussions like this, in webinars. What is it that the chapters in this book bring to the table that perhaps we've not been aware of before?
I'm not sure I agree with you that the connection to nuclear proliferation, nuclear weapons proliferation, is discussed widely and broadly. I think it's discussed in your circles widely and broadly, and I think there are sources. But in the public sphere, I think there has been a substantial effort to claim that those two, that nuclear power is not a factor in nuclear weapons proliferation. And so what I tried to do in that chapter, with obviously with Aaron's help, is to show that nuclear power is a necessary but not sufficient basis for developing nuclear weapons. And for me, the example, which is again is in the news and is more acute now than when we wrote the chapter and when it went to press, is Iran. You know, Iran is enriching uranium, and they claim that it's for peaceful purposes, but then they keep enriching more higher and higher levels. And it's clear they're not only interested in it for peaceful purposes. Israel clearly is aware that that's not the case and has done everything they can to stop it. So that relationship of either enriching uranium or using waste from nuclear power plants to extract plutonium is a very critical part of having the capacity. It's not the only part, but it's a critical part of having the capacity to build nuclear weapons. And I think the public is not, if you went out on the street and asked a bunch of people, I think most people would not have a grasp of that problem or think that that was a serious concern or a problem, despite the news coverage of Iran. So I feel like that at least the weapons proliferation issue is one that has not gotten its fair attention. Now, I think the high-level nuclear waste has gotten more attention, but I wonder if many Americans are aware how widespread that problem is. It's not just the United States. The United States is in a particularly bad position in terms of finding a way to dispose of this waste. There has to be a way, right? I mean, it's already been generated. So there has to be ultimately be a solution. But, you know, the first country very recently to have a geological repository for high-level waste is Finland. And that is just in the last couple of years. I don't know whether it's come online. I don't know if, Aaron, if you've been following it. It's been cited. It's being built. I don't know that it's actually in use yet. But this is 70 years after we started generating this high level waste, finally the first repository is online. And, you know, in my opinion, there are questions and concerns about whether that's even going to be adequate or not in the long run. So I think there is an awareness about high level nuclear waste. I think it is probably fairly superficial in most of the public and should be taken to heart in a more serious way.
If I may add, I think a nice thing that the book brings forward that isn't widely appreciated is just how little material is required to make a bomb, how little material is required for criticality. I feel like the story from Carl Morgan about a criticality accident at Y-12 that happened because a janitor put a bucket under some leaky equipment and a nuclear bomb basically went off in their laboratory. It takes very little material. So in a case where 5 pounds of plutonium, I mean, that's like a fist size amount. Are you going to keep track throughout the whole world of little 5 pound nuggets of metal stuff? Like, it's extremely dangerous material. The uranium bomb is much larger, but once you have enrichment, that's a genie. You can't put it back in the bottle for the most part. Another thing that I learned, actually, that I didn't really know is that there have been countries that built the bomb and then renounced it. So in terms of nuclear nonproliferation, that's really interesting. Now, South Africa, probably in collaboration with Israel and France, you know, had a nuclear program. They detonated a bomb, and then they went back. They don't have the capability any longer. So I find that story really, A, really hopeful, and B, not widely known.
I've said this for a number of years, but how many enemy countries facing each other off with nuclear weapons do we want? You know, now we've got North Korea has nuclear weapons. We've got Pakistan and India. Israel has nuclear weapons. Maybe Iran is going to build one. Even if it takes decades or a century for to have more and more and more of these, it just doesn't seem like a good idea to me. At some point, something's going to go wrong. And so I think we need to rein back the number of countries and the number of nuclear weapons. And I don't think spreading nuclear power to a lot of new countries is helpful in that scheme of things.
If I had the opportunity to write an additional chapter, which eventually we abandoned, I think Something's Gonna Go Wrong would have been a good title for the final chapter. Yeah. Because that's how I feel about a nuclear power plant as well. These things are not simple. Any machine that you make is going to break at some point in some way that you didn't predict. And the consequences of that are a thing that you can't understand. And we have a nice list of how many nuclear accidents there have been in the book.
That was a very helpful contribution of yours, Aaron, because I wasn't aware of how long the list was. And I know the public thinks Chernobyl and Fukushima now, and people who are old enough think Three Mile Island. But beyond that, I don't think there's a substantial public awareness of the large number of other accidents or near accidents that have happened.
Yeah, right. If I may finish that thought, the public pronouncements are all about technical competence and ability and how wonderful our technology is. That's a badly informed view of what engineering is. Real engineers know that everything leaks and everything breaks eventually, and understands the limits of your knowledge in these very complicated systems. So as a very fancy engineer guy, I actually get very incensed when engineers say, oh, it doesn't leak, it's fine, we know exactly what it's going to be. It's fantasy, it's not engineering. It makes me very upset. I wish ordinary people would look at those experts and just say, you're full of yourself, because it's hubris.
No, you're absolutely right. But the added point is that the consequences are so substantial with nuclear power. If you're talking about the failure of 1 in 10,000 cars to have their brakes not work right or something, that's bad, but it's not the same as Chernobyl or Fukushima. So I think there has to be a very high standard. And that's part of why nuclear is so expensive, because especially in the United States, is because there's a lot of regulation. You know, whether that's sufficient or not. But some of the pushback is to loosen up the regulation so it won't be so expensive, so you can build these things faster and less expensive. For me, the opportunity cost that Aaron started with is the real nail in the coffin, though, because ultimately, if nuclear is too expensive and too slow, that just renders it, putting everything else aside, and the other things should not be put aside. They are serious, important issues. But all by itself, the economic problem really seals the argument, in my opinion, about whether nuclear is a viable option or not.
One of the dangers that you did go into great detail about are in a chapter called The Impossible Battle Against Dust. And by this, we mean radioactive dust. What causes it? Where is it found? And what makes it such a danger separate from all the others that we are familiar with and talk about?
I was just talking to a reporter about uranium mining. So radon is a product of the uranium decay series. The decay series itself is a remarkable thing. Its atoms, which are usually indestructible and eternal, giving off a radioactive particle and changing into a different element. And that's a remarkable thing. And the uranium decay series is particularly remarkable because it has so many steps. It goes through thorium and back to uranium and then to radium and then to radon. And radon is a gas. And all of those decay series, radon is the one gas, and it has a half-life of about 4 days. It can seep out of the rocks or soil and get into the air. And then when it decays, it turns into a series of so-called radon progeny, which are additional solid, in this case, radioisotopes that are also radioactive. And because they're solid, they attach themselves to particles in the air. You breathe them in, and then they can lodge in your lungs and continue giving off radiation as the decay series continues. And that damage is extremely strong. I believe radon or radon progeny really is probably the most potent carcinogen that we know of. Very tiny amounts increase the risk of lung cancer. And in the early years in many countries, not just the United States, uranium miners suffered egregious harm from working in underground mines with poor ventilation. But there are ways of reducing that risk. I don't think there's ways of eliminating it if you're underground. It's also a risk in some people's homes. If a home is built on rock that has uranium in it, uranium ore in it, and is built in such a way that it can diffuse into the home, then you get radon in homes. And actually, radon is the second leading cause of lung cancer after tobacco smoke, smoking tobacco in the US. So radon is a very serious concern. It's part of uranium mining. It's a primary reason that uranium mining is so much more hazardous. Underground uranium mining is so much more hazardous than other kinds of mining. And the legacy of damage that it left, not just in the US, which I go into in that chapter, but around the world, wherever uranium was mined in the 50s and 60s, is quite significant. And I don't think they say it anymore, but it used to be this mantra in the pro-nuclear world that nuclear never killed anyone. Well, there are tens of thousands of uranium miners who died. There's just no question about that. It is proven beyond a doubt over and over and over again. Some of it was silica dust, but a lot of it was lung cancer from radon or radon progeny. So that's an aspect of this that I think is that's what you wanted me to talk about, Aaron.
In terms of number of deaths and nuclear never killed anybody, which Doug just pointed out, in some ways I view what we tried to do in this book as a means of asking for a proper accounting. This is about accountability. On one side, you have a group of individuals, a group of institutions saying, this is good, there are no harms, no one dies, it's environmentally friendly. And we're like, no, let's take the problem apart piece by piece and look at what a proper accounting looks like. Now, it's a big question. There should be a proper accounting also of how many people die from particulate air pollution when you burn coal, how many people die of particulate air pollution when you burn gas. And one of the things I liked about this project is that Doug is an expert on particulate matter and air pollution. So we definitely had this in our minds all that time. But it's about accounting. It's about recognizing what all the risks are and enumerating them. Now, about the section of the chapter on accidents you're asking about, Libby. Dust is an issue with nuclear power plant accidents because the materials in a nuclear reactor are ceramics in many cases. So a ceramic is like a coffee mug, and if you drop your coffee mug on the floor and it shatters, there are little pieces of that material all over the floor, from shards that you can pick up down to little dust pieces of dust that are microns in size, a fraction of a millimeter in size, that you can try to vacuum up, but if they're left around, they'll blow in the air and you could breathe them in. And that's what a ceramic is. That's what a ceramic is like. Now, the ceramics in a nuclear reactor, A, are radioactive, and B, they're in a situation where they're heated to extremely high temperatures and the whole thing is vibrating. And in the case of Chernobyl or Fukushima, it exploded after melting. And those accidents lost containment. So there were probably 6 tons of radioactive material expelled from the Chernobyl reactor as dust, and it blew over a vast area. There's a story in the chapter, which I lift from an excellent book by Professor Brown at MIT, about the dust wound up in the coats of sheep, and the workers in the mill where the wool was collected from the sheep got radiation poisoning, and a lot of them died very horribly of radiation sickness. This is because of small pieces of dust. And there's a nice picture in that chapter that I think really brings it home. A gentleman in Japan wore a mask like we all wore during COVID. This was before COVID, of course. And he's 150 miles from Fukushima. But this was, I think, March 13th of 2011. There was a plume from Fukushima, blew over. He went outside. And there are tiny particles of dust laden with radioactive cesium that got caught in the mask. And he kept the mask in a drawer. And 10 years later, he went back and he put a piece of film. This is how radioactivity was discovered, by putting a piece of photographic film on top of a sample of uranium. And you can still see the radioactivity from the cesium microparticles on that mask 10 years later. They're still there. All right. So if you were outside in Tokyo, which honestly probably should have been evacuated after Fukushima happened, except that you can't evacuate a city of 15 million people. They have nowhere to go and no way to get to anywhere. If you were outside, those cesium microparticles were in your body. You breathed them in. They're in your lungs. And anyone who denied, that's not good. No one will say that it's good. Just how dangerous it is actually a question. I think the real answer is no, but it can't be denied that that was there. At the time, I remember aware of some work where people took air filters out of cars in Seattle a week or 2 weeks after Fukushima, and those air filters were radioactive because the plume from Fukushima blew across the Pacific Ocean, and you know it was there in the United States as well. I also saw some of that radiation came over in the jet stream and rained out over places like St. Louis, and there were detections of that as well. So it's worldwide, A, I think I got a little bit off track here, but B, how do you corral several tons of material dispersed into tiny particles of micron size you can't even see? That is an impossible battle. It can't be done. So that seems to me to be a serious problem that people don't talk about.
At least for me, you mentioned burning coal. Burning coal is not the answer, and it shouldn't be a trade-off of nuclear or coal. Burning coal is extremely destructive and harmful, and it causes a lot of death and illness around the world. So I just want to be clear about that.
Yeah, this is why I like working with an expert in particular air pollution. The point I was trying to make, if I failed to make it correctly, is a proper accounting looks at all the harms among all the options.
Well, one of the very interesting things, very new research emerging, which we did not discuss in the book, is this particulate air pollution, which is extremely toxic and is one of the leading causes of mortality and morbidity globally. Recently, it has radiation on it, wherever it's coming from. And that radiation is independent of the particle mass associated with adverse health outcomes in some very leading edge new research. So maybe the two issues are not so unrelated as you might think they are.
I'm not ready to write another book.
How long has the book been out, and what has been the response to it so far?
Yeah, what has it been, about 3 weeks, Aaron? One of the things that we did, which I think has helped, is the ebook is a free download. And so far, there's over 9,000 downloads. Those are not all separate individuals. Maybe they downloaded a couple of chapters rather than the whole book or all the chapters. Aaron, you said your mother downloaded it chapter by chapter. I don't know if you were joking or serious, but I think that's a fairly good response. But I do worry that so far, most of the enthusiasm is people like us who are already critical or skeptical or opposed to nuclear power. And part one of the goals of the book for me was to reach people who are either not very knowledgeable or on the edge or maybe even pro-nuclear power, but haven't thought about all the arguments. so that it generates some thinking and maybe even changes some people's minds about the issue. So I don't know how far we have made it in that way yet.
Still early days on that.
Absolutely. There's a lot of time to go. And I think we need to do interviews like this, like the one I just did with a reporter, and reach a broader audience that's not already so interested in the issue.
The book is Dirty Secrets of Nuclear Power in an Era of Climate Change. We will link to the free PDF download on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode. And for now, Aaron Datesman and Doug Brigge, thank you so much for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Well, it was a pleasure.
Thank you. That was really interesting.
Doug Brigge and Aaron Datesman. They are co-authors of the new book, Dirty Secrets of Nuclear Power in an Era of Climate Change. This was the second of a two-part interview. Part one was on last week's Nuclear Hot Seat, number 697. The link is, of course, up on the website. You can get a free PDF of the book by going to our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 698, and clicking on the link to the free download.
Activists, shout out.
ICAN Australia has released a new 20-page report on the intersections between climate chaos and nuclear weapons, and why nuclear disarmament is a climate action. We will have a link up so that you can read it yourself, but some of the report's key findings are that smoke from burning cities ignited by a nuclear war involving 2% of the global arsenal would suddenly plummet temperatures worldwide to ice age levels, decimate agriculture, disrupt ocean food chains, and starve to death over 2 billion people. An increased risk of war leading to nuclear escalation is the greatest danger of the climate crisis. Nuclear power inseparably creates the capacity to build nuclear weapons. In most nuclear-armed states, the infrastructure, personnel, expertise, industrial capacity, and government investments in nuclear power are also key to their nuclear weapons programs. And nuclear reactors, spent fuel storage ponds, and reprocessing plants are effectively pre-positioned large radiological weapons, vulnerable to direct attack or disruption of power and water for essential cooling. Again, we will link to where you can download this report on nuclearhotseat.com under this episode, number 698. If you're in the Cincinnati area and within the range of Local 12 WKRC television, reporter Dwayne Pullman aired his first part of a special report called Faces of Fallout. It's about the hundreds of people who have been victims of cancer in one way or another from the Portsmouth Gaseous Diffusion Plant in Piketon, Ohio. The first installment of this series was aired on November 4th, and others will follow. Check the station website for details. And in Canada, on November 29th, at the Friends House in Toronto, there will be a debate on the current state of Canada's nuclear weapons policy, what the government should do, and how the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, the TPNW, plays a role in that. Speakers are currently being confirmed, and if you're interested in joining the event in Toronto live, we'll have a link up on the website to where you can RSVP. No charge to attend, but there is limited seating. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, November 5th, 2024. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, it's easy. At nuclearhotseat.com, just fill out the yellow opt-in box. You really cannot miss this little guy. Put in your first name and email address, and every week you will receive one, just one, email, which contains a link to that week's show as soon as it posts and a short description of the show's content. Or, if you're a regular podcast listener, go to your favorite platform and sign up there. Either way, the goal is for you never to have to miss a single episode of Nuclear Hot Seat. If you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com with that information in it. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help, especially considering the travel that is coming up during the next 5 months. And our 700th episode, which is going to be in 2 weeks. Anything you can provide helps, and we will really appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2024, Libby Halevi and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. We're going to go out this week on a song by Tom Lehrer, a great topical musical satirist who has generously released all of his recordings to the public domain, which is why we can use it. Here, his song about nuclear war, "We Will All Go Together When We Go." For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you that we are defined by our traumas and our tragedies and how we respond to them. So let's take this moment to regroup, be gentle with ourselves, and then let's get to work. There you have it. You have just had your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we're all in the nuclear hot seat. And here's Tom Lehrer.
When you attend a funeral, it is sad to think that sooner or later those you love will do the same for you. And you may have thought it tragic, not to mention other adjectives, to think of all the weeping they will do. But don't you worry, no more ashes, no more sackcloth, and an armband made of black cloth will someday nevermore adorn a sleeve. For if the bomb that drops on you gets your friends and neighbors too, there'll be nobody left behind to grieve, and we will all go together when we go. What a comforting fact that is to know. Universal bereavement, an inspiring achievement. Yes, we all will go together when we go. We will all go together when we go, all suffused with an incandescent glow. No one will have the endurance to collect on his insurance. Lloyd's of London will be loaded when they go. We will all fry together when we fry. We'll be French fried potatoes by and by. There will be no more misery when the world is our rotisserie. Yes, we all will fry together when we fry. We will all bake together when we bake. There'll be nobody present at the wake. With complete participation in that grand incineration, nearly 3 billion hunks of well-done steak. We will all char together when we char, and let there be no moaning of the bar. Just sing out a te deum when you see that ICBM, and the party will be come as you are. We will all burn together when we burn. There'll be no need to stand and wait your turn. When it's time for the fallout and St. Peter calls us all out, we'll just drop our agendas and adjourn. We will all go together when we go. Every Hottentot and every Eskimo. When the air becomes Uranus, we will all go simultaneous. Yes, we all will go together when we all go together. Yes, we all will go together when we go together.